Welcome to Memphis Metropolis on WYXR 91.7 FM. I'm your host, Emily Trenum. Memphis Metropolis is all about our city as an urban place, including its neighborhoods, buildings, pathways, and parks, as well as the people who shape it. Join us each week as community leaders and commentators talk with me about our shared built environment. Hi, everybody. Welcome back to Memphis Metropolis on WYXR 91.7 FM. I'm Emily Trenum, the Memphis Metropolis host. And this week, I've got Andrew Murray. I'm going to only read this long title and organizational name one time, probably. He's the president of the City of Memphis and Shelby County Community Redevelopment Agency. And we're going to talk, it sounds you know, kind of dry, but it's important, an important organization. We're going to talk more about that today. But welcome to the program, Andrew.
Thank you for having me.
So, you know, I'd like to, I love neighborhoods. That's sort of my thing. And so I like when I have guests on, of course, a lot of times people are from Memphis and I like to hear about what neighborhoods they grew up in. But you're actually not from Memphis, and you've lived here several years, but not that long in the greater scheme of things. So tell me a little bit about your, your personal and professional journey and how you got to, what brought you to Memphis.
Yeah, so I grew up all over. Whenever anyone asks me that question, where are you from, I always have to consider if they want to hear the whole story or if they're just being polite. But I grew up primarily in middle, high school, and college. I lived in the Ozarks. And so I grew up in the Ozarks primarily. Before that, lived in some parts of the Midwest and West. But really, I grew up in small town Ozarks, and you know, interestingly, my parents lived in the Delta for a while. My sister went to college in Arkansas, and so you know, I've been in and around Memphis, I guess, quite a bit growing up. But that's where I'm from. Went to school in Illinois. Lived in Florida, different places, and then last place I lived before Memphis was St. Louis, before we started the Community Redevelopment Agency.
And you were working for the agency as a consultant, if I remember correctly, and I guess loved it or got induced to come here and become part of its staff.
Yeah, a little bit of both of those things. So, We spun the organization out as its own entity back in 2017, 2018, and then recruited an executive director, President Rosalind Willis, who many of your listeners will know, her and her family. And, you know, she led the agency until about a year, a little over a year ago when she retired. And so she kind of got us from a startup into an organization of now we have 12 people.
Yeah, when I first started working in community development, and for quite a long time, the dedicated CRA staff basically was zero. And it was embedded in the Division of Planning and Development, I believe, and then was staffed by their staff when needed. And was always a great source of frustration for, you know, for community developers who saw the great potential of the tool. And maybe we'll talk about that a little bit more later. But, you know, the tools that your organization brings to the table can be very powerful. And they were just kind of tucked away in a drawer, as it were.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, it's tough to kind of do your own thing if you don't have your own dedicated staff, and that's and I think it was probably a source of frustration for the planning department too. They kind of got handed this thing, and you know, didn't really fully realize its potential. A lot of good work was done in Uptown specifically,
oh sure,
but But, you know, it wasn't really the city and the county's redevelopment agency, which it is now. So
let's talk about, I guess before we get too far ahead of ourselves, let's talk about, so your organization, generally people call it CRA as an abbreviation for Community Redevelopment Agency. And of course, in community development, CRA can have more than one meaning, as you know. But having said that, I'm going to refer to it as CRA for this conversation. So talk a little bit about what CRA is, you know, what's the mission and the, you know, the structure of it. And I mean, what do you do? I always say, what's the elevator speech for, I don't know if you could, an elevator ride's not really enough, to capture it all, but give me the executive summary.
Yeah, so we essentially serve neighborhoods in Shelby County by using tax increment financing, which is a jargon term, a community-based approach to fight blight and provide affordable housing. So those are our two missions, is fighting blight and providing affordable housing. And that's really fairly simple. I think most neighborhoods can understand that. We are a community-based and a neighborhood-based approach.
So let's talk about the, before I ring my bell, let's talk about what tax increment financing is, because it really dictates and funds where you work.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so tax increment financing is one of those unique tools that was created in the 1980s as the amount of federal money for community development block grants and things like that decreased. During the 80s, there was a lot more focus on local versus federal or local versus state. And so it was a tool that was created to essentially allow communities to help themselves, you know, and that was the thought behind it. How it is generally used across the country is for developers to subsidize their developments that may be doing things that the market won't do on its own. So, for example, a stadium or a Main Street redevelopment or a historic building rehab or something more community minded like a park, where you don't, that, you know, the market isn't going to naturally do that, but the but you know, with some tax increment financing, that using that mechanism, you can get the financing to make sense. And you know, to use one of our new mayor Paul Young's terms that he loves to use, is to build that capital stack for the project.
Okay, I'm ringing my bell. Okay, I know what a capital stack is, but now you have to define it.
Yes. So, I mean, I think this is something we talk about a lot in the neighborhoods where we work. For a market-based project, you just go to your local lender, and your lender lends you the money, and you bring some of your money, and you got some of the lender's money from your bank, and you know, away you go, right? But in most of the communities that I've worked in over the years, using tax increment financing, which is my specialty, both in rural impoverished areas and in urban impoverished areas that have seen disinvestment, you have a lot of, you know, redlining, essentially, by lenders, or the market just doesn't want to do what the community wants it to do. And so you have to get creative about other sources of funding outside of those lenders. And so that's essentially what a capital stack starts to look like. It's a stack of different financial resources that are put together. So it could look like some tax credit money, or tax increment financing, or a special
or
tax,
grants,
or a grant, or philanthropic money, or a GoFundMe type thing. You know, I mean, there's different ways to get stuff to happen that, you know, your local lender and developer aren't going to do on their own. You may even use the local lender and the developer and get 75% of the way, and you need that last 25% to make the project, you know, to get the developer or even the nonprofit to be able to do the project, because it's got to pay for itself.
Yeah, people, I think, and, you know, before I got, you know, worked in the field, I had no idea. You know, it's just hard to imagine how difficult it is to finance a lot of it. You know, people drove up and down Cleveland forever saying, you know, someone really needs to do something with that Sears building. And, you know, when that, of course, that was a very large project, but when all is said and done, there were so many funding sources. I think I always say there was duct tape at the end. I mean, to hold it all together. And of course, you don't work for the most part on projects that big. But like I said, we're going to talk more about North Memphis, like Northside High redevelopment in the Klonex Smoky City neighborhood that the Works is working on. That has a lot of, that has a very big capital stack. And like I said, people just, you know, it's just, it blows your mind how many funding sources are needed and how much creativity, as you said, is needed to bring these projects to fruition.
Yeah, and I think that's critical in order to realize the community plans. You know, everything we do comes from the community, from the neighborhoods that we serve, and it's their plans that we're implementing. And in order to get there, you know, in most cases, we can't just go to a local developer or a lender and get it done. And so, you know, working with these different sources, and tax increment financing is one of those. One of those sources that we can use.
So as we were saying earlier, the and I don't want to get too much into the weeds, but you have several districts that you work in, and so what determines what becomes eligible for to become what people call a TIF district? Is it, you know, income or tax revenues? What's the, in plain language, what's the criteria for being designated a TIF district?
Yes, yeah, so in order to have tax increment financing, you've got to have an increment. Well, you've got to have a growth in tax value. So how TIF works is it captures that growth. So the current taxes that are being paid on a site or a neighborhood continue to go to the city and the county, but any increase in that, you know, gets captured, put into a fund. Well, actually, a portion of it gets captured and put into a fund because money still goes to the schools and to the debt service. And so that, you know, that money gets captured, put into a fund, and then used in the neighborhood. So in order to have a tax increment financing district, you have to have what we call a generator. So in the case of Uptown, most folks who are familiar with this at all will know about that TIF. We have an increment, a growth in taxes that came from Harbortown and Mud Island. And the district was put in place before that was fully built out. So there's been a lot of growth over the base tax value in the last now about 20 years. And so that, you know, that money, it continues to grow over time, and the taxes that are paid there go into the fund that then benefits the bigger area.
So what about Klondike, Smoky City? I know that's a new TIF district, which is wonderful because that neighborhood needs reinvestment. Obviously some of these neighborhoods are appreciating anyway. The neighborhoods that are closer to downtown within the loop are appreciating just generally. But was there a particular event or development that triggered that?
Yeah, so there's two things going on there. So the Uptown TIF district was expanded to include Smoky City Most of New Chicago, the rest are Bickford, and you know, a little part of the medical district. Essentially, everything west of the interstate and north of Poplar is in that district. And so, that district, the rest of those neighborhoods, and it really was the balance of neighborhoods. Half of the neighborhood was in, half of it wasn't originally. So, when we created the Uptown redevelopment plan back in 2018. We subsequently went back and added in 2019 those areas, and so that those neighborhoods are getting the increment from Harbortown and Mud Island, but crossing the interstate, you get into Klondike going if you're going east, and the Klondike TIF is brand new, and so it has no money because there really is no increment at this point. But about a third of the neighborhood is owned by the Klondike Smoke City CDC or the Works or different, they call it the partnership. There's multiple different entities that own about a third of the neighborhood, mainly vacant lots. And their plan is to, you know, redevelop those into affordable housing, to redo, you know, you mentioned Northside. You know, the Works, Rashawn Austin, the rest of them, they have a, you know, a big community led plan, led by the CDC there to do a lot of redevelopment. And those houses will end up on the tax rolls when houses are built on vacant lots. And that is what's anticipated to create the increment that then will go into sidewalks or home repair or some of these other things that can pull from the fund.
So I know we can't, you know, we don't have time to talk about all the, you know, the TIF districts now, and I really want to, you know, do a little bit of a deeper dive into those North Memphis areas, but just tick off what the TIF other TIF districts are that we haven't talked about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so there's two others that I haven't mentioned. One is Soulsville, South Memphis. Essentially, it's the McLemore corridor and kind of Gaston Park area. Goes over to Bellevue, and that's also like the Klondike one. It's brand new. It's in the first year of operation. There's no money there, and there probably won't be for quite a while because there's not a lot of development scheduled for that area. But we're hopeful, and you know, we're working with partners over there to encourage a private sector development in the area that is community oriented and community informed. And then the other TIF that we have is an older TIF, which is a limited, what we call a site specific TIF, and that's Highland Row. That one is just essentially the parking garage and the development where Char, French Truck, Coffee, there's some other entities, you know, businesses there. That's a site specific TIF that funded the parking garage that created that mixed use development. Oh, and I'm sorry.
Binghamton.
My favorite people.
Well, I think that's how how we met.
Binghamton. Yes, yes. Yes, they're going to give me a hard time about forgetting them. No, Binghamton was actually the second community-based TIF that we did. And you're right. You and I met doing that. That was sponsored and really led by the Binghamton Development Corporation. And a bunch of other organizations too, CTC and Broad Avenue District and some other organizations that got together. That one has a little bit of money in it. It's 5-6 years old at this point. We've started to see some increment come through. A lot of stuff over there ended up being tax abated, which, you know, maybe another jargony term, but you don't pay your taxes essentially.
Right. Like if you're a church, you're a big church, for example.
Yes, if you're a big church or you're a developer and you get a what we call pilots here, but it's essentially you get your taxes waived. Yep. That if you're not paying taxes, then it means there's no tax increment, which means there's no TIF
money. I know. Money. Tax abatement can be a mixed blessing for that reason. Yeah, Binghamton is, I think, always the sense was, and this is probably true of a lot of your districts, including South Memphis, you put them in place, but it's going to take a while, as maybe up to 20 years, to really generate the kind of money that to address some of the needs that were identified by the community.
Yeah, that's right. And I think both of the districts and honestly Uptown as well, they were imagined as a way to capture that growth in tax value that was coming. And you know, the growth in tax value of a neighborhood is a blessing and a curse, because it means if you own a home or a business, you get equity, and maybe you can get some investment from your lender, and you know, you can pass on an asset to the next generation. We talk a lot about generational wealth creation here at the CRA. That's one of our main missions, is to make sure that what we do creates generational wealth. And one of the ways you do that is by increasing the value of your home or your business or your property. The flip side of that is if you're a renter, or if you're older and on a fixed income, as your tax bill goes up, right? That helps the TIF, but it doesn't help you, and it might mean that you have to leave the neighborhood. And so, you know, while there's things in place, for example, for especially senior citizens to get, you know, their taxes frozen and that kind of thing, the danger is that people are pushed out of the neighborhood. And so the idea of the Soulsville and the Binghamton and to some extent the Uptown TIF was to put the neighborhood back in the driver's seat, to make sure that as that money is captured, it stays in the neighborhood and it goes for fighting blight and providing affordable housing and making sure that the people that are benefiting from the improvements in the neighborhood are the neighbors. And so that's something we're passionate about. And it, and I think in Binghamton, it's working, that mechanism is already starting to work well. So we, for example, we did our first 19 houses we've started in our home repair program over there. So these are long time, you know, for the most part, long time homeowners in Binghamton that are getting home repairs done, so that they, as their property values go up, they have an asset that they can stay in their home as they age, and then also pass on to the next generation, and or the next generation can live in there if either sell it or live in the house.
Yeah, I think the fact that the part of the increase in property values and taxes stays in the neighborhood is one of the things that's, you know, powerful about TIF. Before we just talk about North Memphis, you said your two main goals were affordable housing and then blight remediation. But just drill down a little bit. I mean, you talked about home repair programs, but you know, you do a lot of things that probably fall under that blight remediation bucket.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and especially in Uptown over the last few years with COVID and different things that have happened, a lot of our focus has been more on fighting blight and then the affordable housing. Our focus has shifted somewhat more to affordable housing in the last year, and I plan on, you know, pushing that forward in the future. But, you know, the way that we do that is important. The way that we fight blight in our neighborhoods is important. And it's really informed by how the neighborhood wants the improvements to the neighborhood to be. And so it's not an outside group. And I even put the CRA in that bucket. Coming in, telling the neighborhood, you know, you need to, you know, we need to fix this up, we need to do that. The goal is to implement what the community's plan is. And the way we do that in Uptown, for example, where we, you know, we're in year 20 something of the TIF, so we have a steady source of revenue, is we've purchased a lot of lots that we've cleaned up that essentially were abandoned, and properties and structures that we've torn down or rehabbed. That's one thing we do. We have teams of entrepreneurs that maintain those lots and those properties. And also those same teams, in some cases, do what we call block wellness. So they clean up the streets. The city does what they do, but then these folks come behind and they sort of do a value-added improvement. And the great thing about those entrepreneurs is, for the most part, they're from the neighborhood. They're all minority owned and local, and they are hiring, in many cases, older or younger folks from the neighborhood that may be underemployed, and getting them employed and giving back to their own community. And so when we talk about creating generational wealth, you know, while entrepreneurship and economic development are not our primary functions, it's fighting blight and providing affordable housing, the way that we do those two functions is critical in the way that we spend those TIF dollars to make sure that the money creates that wealth in Memphis. Because, you know, one of my things that my soapbox is that, you know, in Memphis we have poor and we have wealthy. We don't have a lot of folks in the middle, and that's unhealthy. And it creates a lack of opportunities for our folks. And so we need to make sure that, you know, the way we're doing things doesn't concentrate wealth. It spreads wealth out and creates generational wealth that's able to be transferred over time.
So if you're just joining us, you're listening to Memphis Metropolis and WYXR 91.7 FM. And I'm talking to Andrew Murray, who's the president of the Memphis and Shelby County Community Redevelopment Agency. And we're talking about what CRA does, where it works, tax increment financing, and lots of other sexy topics. So speaking of something that's not sexy, I have a category of things I call boring but important. And a lot of, you know, planning and community development falls in that category. But one thing you do a lot of is, you know, sidewalk repair, which is boring but incredibly important. And so you don't even have to comment. And I just wanted to call out sidewalk repair because, I mean, and just, you know, repairing the, you know, the sometimes it's lighting. I mean, just those things are incredibly important for safety, transportation, all of those things.
Yeah, in the Uptown District, we did a full assessment. Janine Heyer with Safeways helped us with that back in 2018 and 2019. And we did a whole sort of cataloging of the entire Uptown TIF District, which, you know, just to recap, is Uptown, which former Greenlaw, Bickford, Bearwater, Smoky City, New Chicago, and part of the Medical District, and that in the Pinch. And that area, you know, we looked at every sidewalk, every street light. And so, as you were mentioning, you know, we've done six to 8 miles of sidewalks in mainly the Smoky City area. And I think it's critical because it's a safety thing, but it's also, once again, goes back to that generational wealth thing, because if you own your house, you're responsible for the sidewalk in front of your house, and it costs between $3,000 and $8,000 to fix your sidewalk. That is money that most of these folks, many of them on fixed incomes, can't afford. But, you know, what the city will do, because they have to from a legal perspective, is they'll come in and get somebody to repair the sidewalk, and they'll put a lien on your house if there's a complaint. And so what we were seeing is unscrupulous folks actually using the 311 system and the complaint system to try to get liens on people's houses.
Really?
So, you know, oh, absolutely. And so what we, you know, it's one of those situations that, you know, no good deed goes unpunished type of thing. You know, you've got this 311 system that's meant to help people that somebody's using to essentially take advantage of seniors. And so what we did is we said, okay, we partnered with the city and we said, okay, well, what if we use some of the TIF money to just repair the sidewalks? Don't put any liens on. We'll just, you know, that's what this money is for. And we've had a pretty successful partnership with the city on repairing sidewalks. And we've actually got one that's under construction right now on Manassas, just south of the interstate, kind of there along by Peach and Mosby, that kind of area.
So let's talk about the, as you said, the original Uptown TIF District, which I think the northern boundary was Chelsea, if I'm remembering correctly, but it was expanded not that long ago to include those other neighborhoods you mentioned, part of New Chicago, Smoky City, and then the Klondike TIF, which is separate but adjacent, more or less. So talk to me about some of the projects that you're specific project, not necessarily the home repair, specific projects you're working on that you're really excited about?
Yeah, so it's kind of interesting. The Uptown TIF, when it was created, you know, it includes Hardtown and Mud Island, and then includes what folks call the Greenlaw neighborhood, which we call Uptown now. And it actually did include north of Chelsea, and it did include a big chunk of Smoky City. But there was a planning target area where the funds were really focused just on Greenlaw. And there were some projects that were done outside of that area, but the focus of the master developer at the time was really Hurt Village and, you know, the area kind of closer to St. Jude and the Pinch. And a lot of really, really good work was done over there. But when the agency became its own entity and we created a community plan, we looked at the whole area and the neighborhoods and the different residents in our Uptown Advisory Committee that was put together. They focused on the whole area. And so over the last 5 years, we've focused the funds on not just Greenlaw, but all the other neighborhoods. And that's, I think, a big difference. And then we extended the district, as I mentioned, you know, to sort of squared it up to include natural boundaries.
Yeah.
You talked about jargon, but some of these boundaries also make no sense. And they were, you know, I think for the average person in the neighborhood, you know, like, well, I live in Smoky City, but I'm not in the district, but my sister is,
right.
You know, that kind of thing. So, but yeah, you mentioned, you asked about projects. So we've got some really cool projects that my predecessor teed up for us, and we're really excited about them. So we've got, I'll just kind of go through a little rundown, but we've got a project that just closed this week. 499 senior, very affordable senior units, very nice quality, high-end stuff, but for low-income seniors. On the north end of Legends, which if folks don't know what Legends is, the old Dixie Homes. So that project is going to be under construction in the next year. Penrose is the developer, and they're working with the Housing Authority and HCD and some other folks to do that. We're putting in a pretty good chunk of money into that. We're working on rehabbing the 299 Chelsea building, which is an old brick white church.
Yeah, what's happening with that? I wanted to do a whole show about it, but I guess it's not. I guess it's not ready for a complete spotlight. But that's iconic.
It is. And it came out of the community plan as a top priority. You know, that it's just, like you said, such an iconic.
It's at Chelsea and North 7th, right?
That's right. Yeah, really close to Danny Thomas and Chelsea. And it's very iconic. It's similar to how Tillman Cove was for Binghamton. And so in the case of Tillman Cove and the case of 299 Chelsea Church, you know, we're focused on both of those projects. And the exciting thing about 299 Chelsea is, you know, it's got tons and tons of history. You really, really ought to have me back and do a show. And
I was rebuffed.
yes. But we're not, you know, we're still working on that. It's a complicated deal. But Hattie Lou Children's Theater is going to be in there. And we're working with Ekandayo over there. And, and you know, some other folks, that it's going to be expensive. It's going to be complicated. It's going to take some time, but that's the plan. The building predates the Civil War.
You know, those historic projects are so important, and I'm a big supporter of historic preservation. It doesn't always make sense, but that's super exciting to me.
Yeah, and while we're talking about historic preservation, we're getting ready to issue a request for proposals for the Porter Leith campus. So our offices are located in the Gould Cottage, which is one of the buildings on Porter Leith's campus, historic campus here. It was Sarah Leith's, you know, farm originally that became an orphanage, and then they built the first building in 1854 or something like that, pre-Civil War. But the big historic orphanage building, we've purchased, partnered with Porter Leith, and then we're looking for somebody to come in and redevelop it, following the community plan, and you know, to reuse the do an adaptive reuse of the historic campus.
Well, based on what the building, the layout is, could it be housing, or I mean, is it suited for that?
It could be. I mean, it needs modern updates. So it needs an elevator put in. And it needs to be ADA. It needs to have a sprinkler system. The building's not in bad shape. It's just historic, and you know, there's some grandfathering of things that have occurred that needs to be brought up to the latest standards. And then, you know, I mean, there's not tons of parking on the site, and so that's going to limit. I mean, it's not going to be a crosstown, you know, but it could be senior
housing. It's a really cool building, so, and deserves, absolutely has a lot of history, deserves to be preserved. But Porter Leith is still on the campus, aren't they?
They are. They have about the north third of the campus. So Sarah's Place for Youth in Crisis is still there, and their early childhood learning, their daycare center, is there too. So they've retained those two things in the community, but their main headquarters, they moved and built a state-of-the-art facility to complete their mission. So we're really excited about putting out the RFP, because I think that it's a real opportunity for a historic preservation developer to partner with the community and do something really neat.
So when you sent me, when we were emailing about this interview, you sent me the CRA annual report from last year, and there was a project in it that I had never heard of, which was the Purple Church. Can you tell me what that is?
Yeah, so it was a little kind of corner store converted into a purple church. The exterior of the church was purple. And so we kind of embrace that. That is a project, like most of our projects, really all of our projects, that came out of the community. So we've got a community partner that runs fitness programs out of that building and a technology training program. It's right next to the North Memphis Green Line, which is a trail that we built over an old railroad bed. That trail connects the what's turning into the Snuff District with Booker T. Washington Park and the Chelsea Green Line and Grand City Brewery and the Carriage District. Those are all kind of right there next to each other. And the Purple Church and the plaza that's going to be built next to it, that trail is all part of a Bickford Bearwater investment. And we've got some really great partners. I know you had Joy from Oasis of Hope on.
I did, and we talked about Washington Park. I said, I mean, I've, you know, been to Washington Park, and you know, but it's, I won't say it's even sort of tucked away. It's just at the very north side of that neighborhood. It's by some industrial areas. I was like, what's going on with Washington Park? And so she and I touched on it, but what can you tell me about that?
Yeah, the trail is completed and actually connects to the park, and through partnered with the Parks District, and we redid the path that goes through the park. The park probably needs some additional investments, and then the Chelsea Green Line is going to connect to the park. But you're right, it has almost a rural feel to it. Across the street is the carriage house and the horses and the grain elevator, and the Grind City Brewery is all kind of there. So it has this almost like a rural feel in the middle of, within view of downtown.
Yeah, I think you could capitalize on that in some way. And also, if I'm remembering right, there's not a lot of housing right there. So probably it doesn't get a lot of, people just walking through. Like a Bearwater Park, where you've got people, you know, living all around it, and so it's easier to activate that kind of a park. But Washington Park has a lot to recommend it, though.
It does, and with the Uptown Community Plan, that was one of the feedback that we got from the neighborhood was connecting that. So the trails will connect the neighborhood to the whole regional trail network. I mean, you'll be able to go from MLK Park all the way up to, you know, the riverfront, all the way out to Eads and the Green Line. And so I think that's important that it connects the neighborhood to the rest of the trail network. But also there's smaller connections. So, you know, there's a couple connections that we're going to make to Washington Park, and the Chelsea Green Line is going to come in. And then we have a lot of land up there that was blighted, that we've cleaned up, that, you know, can be turned into housing, and working with our, you know, Promise Development and Oasis of Hope and, you know, some of our other, you know, CDCs up there to create some housing. And create housing, one of the ideas is to create housing that faces the park, so that there's more eyes on the park.
That's a good idea. So that I'm familiar with the Chelsea Green Line, but you also mentioned the North Memphis Green Line. Is that separate?
It is. We originally called it the Chelsea Green Line Extension, but the Chelsea Green Line hasn't been built yet.
Yeah.
Because it involves federal funds, which take forever. But we were able to build the North Memphis Green Line, which is essentially that rail yard and rail bed that goes between Grind City and Bickford. And that's a great story. I tell folks all the time, the value of a community having a plan is not just to, you know, to plan exactly what's going to happen in the future, but to have a plan and where the community is saying, this is what we want to happen, so that as opportunities come, you can pull that plan out and say, this is what we said we want. So the fascinating story on that one is the railroad actually approached the city and said, we would like to get rid of this rail line, which, you know, if you know anything about railroads, they never do that. And so,
you come with a big check.
Yes, and even then, they just don't like to give up control of right away. And so we said, absolutely. And the great thing was, in the community plan, they had drawn a trail that connected the park to the Snuff District and the Chelsea Green Line and all that. And, you know, I thought it was lovely thought, you know, just jadedly, I guess, that maybe that will never happen. But then when, you know, the opportunity arose, and then Grind City Brewery bought the old furniture factory and wanted to create a space there for gatherings, it just all came together. And the community had already said, this is what we want. And so when the opportunity came, you know, the plan got implemented. And so, you know, I really encourage other neighborhoods, even if you're not in a TIF district, you know, have that plan and have that discussion early, so that as, you know, opportunities or threats come to the neighborhood, you've got your plan to stand on, and you don't have to try to figure out what it is you're trying to do while the threat or the opportunity is there, because you usually have a window of response time. And we were able to, Bickford really was able to seize that opportunity. And
well, and you don't have to make the case for it. The case has already been made.
Yeah. And that's the power of our plans. And so as the neighborhood gets approached, in whatever neighborhood we're working, gets approached by a developer or somebody with a well-intentioned idea, we just pull out the plan and convene our advisory team of neighborhood residents and stakeholders and ask them, what do you think? And that's already there, and it's actually helped a lot. It's helped prevent drama, and it's helped prevent, you know, bad development happening, and then facilitated good development. So another project we're doing right now that came out of the community plan is the redevelopment of the old Chisholm Trail site into a grocery store and affordable housing. And so we put out an RFP. We did a nationwide deal and approached a lot of local folks too, and we have a letter of intent with a developer that's working on a low-income housing tax credit deal, So that's essentially workforce housing plus
it's
a grocery store.
Oh, it is going to
store.
include that's and that's prime real estate.
Yes, it really is. And that site has a lot of funky things going on with it. Everything we own.
Well, it's,
there's a
well,
reason
it's
we own it.
Probably triangular, right? I mean.
Well, yeah, it's got, there's an easement.
So tell people where it is if people don't remember the Chisholm.
It's basically across the street from St.
Okay.
Jude. You know, sort of kitty
right.
corner from the St. Jude campus. And, you know, there was a couple dry cleaners there, a couple gas stations, and I think a Kroger that became Chisholm Trail grocer. And so, you know, we have a letter of intent from a grocer for that site and a letter of intent from the developer. The developer brought the grocer. And that's all probably several years away from, you know, the ground being broken and it being put up.
But because they need to put together
really
the capital stack.
Yes, that is what they are doing. I just had a call this morning about that, actually. So that has some contamination on the corner as well from the dry cleaner and the gas station. So it, you know, when you drive around, I tell folks all the time, when you drive around Memphis or any community and you see a really nice corner that just doesn't seem like there's anything going on with it, either it's a brownfield, so there's underground contamination of soil, or there's some out-of-state likely owner who doesn't want to move on it. And it's usually one of those two situations.
It is. Or there's just or there's insufficient resources. I have, you know, people always say, I always call it the someone oughta discussion. Well, who? Mm-hmm. You know, someone oughta fix
yes.
that up over there. Well, who? and
yes.
whose money? Because we have so much blight, so many. But you're right, every blighted property has a story, and all the stories are different, which from a public policy perspective, having sort of worked in that, can be very frustrating.
Well, I think that's the story of my life is, you know, somebody ought to really do something, and you look around and you realize I'm probably that person, you know, and so my mother always calls me a reluctant leader because, you know, I always think that somebody ought to do something. And I think a lot of our community members are also like that. They've looked around and realized that, hey, no one's coming to save the day. So we're going to have to organize and, you know, go get what we need to get. And that story of the Chisholm Trail site is a great example of that, where you've got neighborhood residents who have said, this is what we want, and we're gonna work to make sure it happens. And they've been patient. They've been working with the CRA on multiple iterations of this. But, you know, I think that their patience and their focused, intent on that will really pay off in the long run.
So you mentioned a couple times the Snuff District, and I don't know whether those projects got, there's many projects, or whether they got pilots or not, but I'm thinking the redevelopment of that area has got to be helpful for the Uptown TIF.
Yeah, you're talking about the Snuff
yeah.
District?
In terms of increment flowing into the account.
So, yes and no. I mean, it's great for the neighborhood, and I think the neighborhood is excited about all the development that's going on. I will say most of the development over there is pilots, tax abatement, right? So, most of the development that's occurred and planned to occur is taking advantage of that, not paying taxes mechanism. And so that doesn't help the TIF.
Maybe someday.
Absolutely. And eventually, you know, the TIF will go away. Eventually the pilots will burn off and the city and the county will receive those tax revenues. We invested quite a bit of money in infrastructure over there, but we didn't invest any money in the sites themselves because they were going after tax abatement. And I think that's probably an important thing that we talk about is you have to either pick TIF or tax abatement, you don't get to do both because they pull from the same revenue source.
Plus, I mean, the city is utilizing you know, tourist development zone money, and some, there's probably not overlap with TIP, but certainly parts of downtown are, they're using that, which really has to do with sales taxes more than property taxes. But yeah, there's, you're right. I mean, there's a lot of different tools, and if they overlap, I think I knew that you can't use more than one. That makes sense.
Yeah, it's a conversation we have a lot of times with developers or even community development corporations, is that, you know, TIF is not a magical bullet that creates a bunch of money. And I think especially here in Memphis, because we have the Uptown success, it, you know, people forget that that was a sandbar with nothing on
yep.
it. And that, you know, Henry Turley and his team and Jack Bells and the rest of them, they created a lot of tax value, and then we're benefiting now years later from that, you know, foresight that he had.
And again, I don't want to get too much into the weeds, but you can blend, though, I mean, different kinds of tax credits. You mentioned low-income housing tax credits. I'm guessing with some of these historic properties, you may want to utilize federal historic tax credits. I'm assuming those can be blended in with tax increment financing.
Yeah, absolutely. And so that is really how I got into this. You know, just to talk a little bit about myself for a second. So I went to planning school and I did community organizing in East St. Louis. And, you know, my goal was never to be a financial person, but I wanted to see communities like the ones that I grew up in that were disinvested and struggling to realize their visions and to be improved. And so the way you do that is through money. And I know money, you know, nonprofits and planners, and we always act like money is a bad thing, but it's not. It's critical. And so the way you get money for projects is by creating that capital stack. And for example, with this Porter Leith campus, it is on the National Register, so it has access to federal historic tax credits. It's in a eligible census tract, so an area of the neighborhood that is considered low income by federal standards, and then has access to low income housing tax credits and new market tax credits and, you know, opportunity zone funds and all these, you know, things that that you can, you know, if you've got clever enough attorneys and developers, you can figure out how to stack those things up and then make the project happen.
So before we end, what have I not asked you that you want to tell me?
So I think what we're doing in Memphis is really beautiful and unusual. And I think that the way we're using tax increment financing is a way that really hardly anywhere else in the world is using it. And the way we're using tax increment financing in Memphis through these community-based districts is a community-based model. So we talk a lot about community benefit agreements and developers working out a deal with neighborhoods, and many of those things are unenforceable. This situation is where the neighborhood is in the driver's seat, and where they have a pool of funding that they're directing. They're working with our board, they're working with the elected officials, but you know, we're not going to the community and asking, "Hey, we came up with this plan. What do you think?" It's, hey, we're implementing your plan. Are we doing it right? But, you know, we check back in regularly. We've got quarterly meetings with our advisory committees. And so I think that community-based approach to incentives is honestly pretty radical. And I think that it's something that we should be proud of. It's challenging. The more people you're involved in things, the more complicated it is. But I think it will be a lasting model that will yield long-term fruit that will actually benefit a wide spectrum of people, rather than just, you know, the sort of the chosen wealthy few. And if anybody knows anything about me, that, you know, that's something I'm very passionate about, is creating that generational wealth and those opportunities for folks. So, you know, that's our goal here at the CRA.
Well, I agree with all of that, and it's just really great. I mean, some of these neighborhoods have been so disinvested, underinvested for decades, mm-hmm. and it's just great to see new energy, new development. It's wonderful, really, really inspiring. So thanks to you and your staff for all the great work.
Yeah, well, thank you for saying that. And I really think that it's a great example of the neighborhoods, Binghamton and Uptown, you know, saying this is what we want, and then pressuring their elected officials, I mean, to get it done, and to go and hire some guy from the Ozarks and, you know, some group of staff to come in and figure it out for them.
So you've been listening to Memphis Metropolis on WYXR 91.7 FM. I've been talking to Andrew Murray, who's the president of the Memphis and Shelby County Community Redevelopment Agency. So, Andrew, thank you so much for coming on the show.
Thank you, and thanks for all of your work over the years, you know, doing such great community development work and you know, your work with the media, too, and making sure that stories are told.
That's needed, definitely. Mm-hmm. You've been listening to Memphis Metropolis on WYXR 91.7 FM. I'm Emily Trenum. Memphis Metropolis airs every Monday at 1, so please tune in again next week. You can listen to past programs on our program page at wyxr.org or on memphismetropolis.com. You can also follow us and send feedback on social media. Now, stay tuned for Memphis Undercover with Nancy.